there's some interesting questions around to what extent will telcos let organizations like PalmPay operate over-the-top mobile money services that directly cannibalize and compete with theirs.
Hello and welcome to the African Tech Roundup, episode 133. This is where we round up the most important tech, digital, and innovation highlights from across the African continent. This show is brought to you in association with our friends at Business Live and, of course, the team at Multimedia Live. Thanks to them, the African Tech Roundup is now available on businesslive.co.za. We're really excited about that. And, of course, you can also find us wherever you stream Multimedia Live podcasts. My name is Andile Masugu. I'm really glad you could join us. I'm terribly excited for this episode because it's been an especially exciting month and a half on the African continent as far as fintech is concerned. And so we've decided to do a fintech signal check, unpacking some of the more interesting plays in the space. Stick around because we're going to get into all of that later. But first, allow me to welcome back to the show the Nigerian homie, the founder and writer of The Subtext, Osaruman Osamui. How you doing, man?
Hi, Andela. How's it going?
I'm very, very well, man.
Great to be back.
And of course, we've got an extra special guest joining us today in the form of Wiza Jalakasi. He's, of course, the Malawian technology entrepreneur extraordinaire, active on the continent for the last 10 years, mostly in stealth mode. He's into all things mobile, formerly at Africa's Talking as the head of business development and the current head of business development at Hover. The man is coming out of his shell these days, and thankfully, he's joining us right here on the show. Welcome to you, Wiza.
Thank you, Andile, for having me on the show. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
You've long been part of the village. This ecosystem, I think, is what it is because of folks like you. Just for the most part, you know, quietly hacking away at some of the, I suppose, more obvious and some not so obvious issues that, you know, we would do well to solve using tech, man. You're an under-PR'd character, man.
Yeah, I suppose so. But like, I make the most noise on Twitter, sharing a couple of thoughts here and there. And I am only now just realizing the value of being more vocal and being more out there. So it's something that I'm working on and plan to take more seriously. But for the time being, you know, I quite like where I am.
Welcome to the light, Wiza. Welcome. I mean, it's grind either way. You work in the dark, you work in the light. It's all the same, brother.
That's true.
Listen, folks, before we jump into this fintech signal check, I thought it'd be fun just to find out what everyone's working on. You know, what's on your proverbial desktop, you know, which tabs are open, you know, that kind of thing. And since you're new to the show, Wiza, we'll start with you, man. What are you up to, man?
So things I can share, just I published an article.
Ooh, damn. What, you see now, you had to do that, right? You had to do that. Now I want to know what you're working on that we can't talk about. What the heck, bro?
Okay, so working on some interesting technology at Hover to enable more African developers, actually developers globally, to plug into USSD based infrastructure. Yeah, we're in the middle of a fundraising round, which is going quite well. And yeah, it's pretty exciting.
You're landing those shekels.
We hope so. We hope so. It's not over until you open the bank account and then there's a few more zeros than they were the day before.
isn't it? It's not over until we hear about it on TechCrunch.
Until you open the bank account and you
see. Isn't that how it works these days?
Yeah. But yeah, things I'm happy about. Recently wrote an article just around the transition from what I describe as mobile money 1.0 into mobile money 2.0 and the features of this new type of mobile money characteristics, what's driving it, competition. And I published that in early October, and I made a few sort of like predictive inclinations towards successful players. And it's just great to see a lot of them like coming out and raising money now and sort of confirming some of the inclinations that I had made. So that's pretty exciting. And it's just exciting to see everything unfold. And a lot of it has been above my expectations. I never thought that companies in Africa would be raising $40 million seed rounds, for example. So yeah, that's super exciting, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen in the industry over the course of the next year or two.
We're totally going to share that article in the show notes. In fact, links to pretty much everything useful we referenced in the show will be made available in the show notes. This article is definitely one to check out. And a lot of the companies that you referenced in that article, we'll be discussing in the show here today.
Weezer, what does it feel like to be an Oracle?
It's not bad, you know. It's really not bad at all. I'm even seeing some signals for what's going to happen next year, but we'll discuss that later on.
off mic, right? Because you're not sharing those secrets. We're going to get them out of you, bro. Don't even try. Also, Ruman, you're a busy man these days. You're popping up in our inbox. The subtext is on an interesting trajectory at the moment. But I mean, perhaps that's what's trending for you, but perhaps it's not. What are you up to there?
Let me answer the first question with great embarrassment. I have 5 windows with roughly 100 tabs open across, actually, probably 150 minimum, mostly because I'm working on lots of things at the same time, where I'm publishing a newsletter alongside DFS Lab called Sufficient Balance, unpacking the opportunities in African fintech, primarily intended for investors who are not familiar with the market. But also, you know, I've heard some good comments since we started publishing 3 weeks ago from the local ecosystem. That's a significant part of, or it's taking up a significant amount of my bandwidth at the moment. Also, for the first time, the Subtext is preparing its subscription product, which should be live in Q1 next year. So I'm doing all the housekeeping
at the moment,
to make that happen. And a bunch of other things I can't talk about yet. So,
you guys, and this so much happening under the surface I can't talk about. You got to make me come over there and hit you over the head with a mic. So, and by the way, where's everyone at?
I'm in Lagos, Nigeria.
And where you at, Wizza?
I am also in Lagos, the center of excellence.
The capital of progress.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think every African needs to visit Lagos at least once to understand what's missing in their city. So yeah, it's quite a fantastic place.
Are you being tongue in cheek now? Because I don't know whether to back you now. I don't know what's going on.
No, you see, the thing, what people miss about Lagos is not, you know, in terms of infrastructure or something you can tangibly see, but it's the people.
Mm. Yeah, it's the hustle, man.
So,
listen, I was reading some academic writing just this week on the science of hustle. You know, it's becoming an area of academic study. And I think it's about time, too, because there is something unique about certain places in the world. And I suppose there's a certain aspect to the environment or the circumstance that influence the people or create a maybe pressure cooker effect or an enabling sort of incubator effect. So there's something to be said for the environment, but there's also something to be said for everything that makes a certain culture prevalent in a place like, say, Lagos, or I'd like to think it's in Harare as well. I'd like to think, you know, there's certain places like Johannesburg, and not to say it's not happening everywhere else and isn't everywhere else, but there has to be a science, a reasonable way to study how and why these dynamics form.
I think you're definitely right. My belief is that population size is a big factor because it contributes to the scarcity of resources, including space. And when that compounds over time, you finding yourself in an environment where you're competing for pretty much everything from day one, it naturally increases your propensity to hustle. I don't have the numbers or the science behind it, but like that's my intuitive feeling and the thing that I notice about it. You find a similar work ethic dynamic in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. It's not as...
Yes, that's another joint.
Yeah, it's not as loud or as, for lack of a better word, aggressive as it might be in Lagos, but you can sense the energy that's there. And then, you know, you go to somewhere like Lilongwe where...
I was going to say, you're Malawian. What's the vibe in Lilongwe, bro?
No, like Malawi is for chilling. It's a chilling country. You know how I realized
you're not going to lose your street cred now. Your people are going to...
No, but we know that we are for chilling, and that's why tourism is such a big thing in Malawi. You know, the day I realized that Malawi was a chilling country was when I moved to Nairobi and I was in the CBD, and then the shops didn't close at 12 and open at 2. They didn't close for lunch. Like they were just open throughout.
Is that still a thing in Lilongwe?
Yeah.
So if I need batteries at 1:30,
if you go into Old Town, where you find a lot of like hardware shops, whatever else, like they close at lunch and then the owners go home for lunch and they come back.
Yeah. Now there has to be more study into all of these. I mean, there's so many oversimplifications about it, even in a positive sense. So even this generalizations we are making, which I think there's enough anecdotal evidence to suggest, you know, it's a real thing. But I think it's also dedicating some time and effort to the science of what makes a Lagos like pump or what makes Lilongwe chill.
Yeah. You know,
that'd be fun to study. Anyway, I'll go last by telling you what's trending for me right now. Like you, Osaruman, I've got a ton of open tabs on my actual laptop. Embarrassing, yes, I know. But what's top of mind for me as far as work I've been doing or work I'm actively doing is, of course, the recently wrapped Ignite 2019 conference in Amsterdam hosted by Spark. Your boy was on stage hosting the people. And we're busy in post-production right now, producing a podcast series in partnership with Spark that's exploring some themes that filtered throughout the event. Really exciting to see folks from fragile states, you know, on the African continent that I don't normally rub shoulders with. And many of us, frankly, don't rub shoulders with, not least because of how difficult it is for them to leave their own countries and travel around the world. Quite notably, I met folks from Libya, which was a fascinating immersion in how they are literally living in an alternate reality at the moment. Yes, my mind and heart are full from all the rich interactions I had at that event, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of the insights gleaned from there. I give a big shout out to the team at Spark for partnering with the African Tech Roundup on that project, but also, you know, a big shout out to everyone I was able to rub shoulders with. Thank you so much to any new listeners right now that have come via that conference. Shout out to you, fam. Welcome to the village. Right, so let's get to it. And really what we're going to do as far as the signal check is concerned is just throw out some of the signals that we consider most relevant, most interesting, most pertinent to the ecosystem and perhaps to the fintech dispensation on the African continent right now. And then we're just going to unpack. I'm really, really excited to have you both here to do the signal check with me as far as fintech is concerned. Both of you actively tracking the space, albeit for different reasons. Also, Ruman's obviously writing about this actively. So are you, actually, Wiza. Both of you, you know, highly opinionated about, you know, what to be excited about. And more importantly, why? I think that's where people differ. I think we're all sort of retweeting the same things, but I want to get under the skin of, you know, why you think it's a big deal. So we'll start with what I consider perhaps one of the more recent highlights to the space. We've had a visit to the continent from a certain Jack Dorsey, most famous probably for being the CEO of Twitter, I think in the mainstream, less so of his involvement with Square, which is interesting to me because I suppose it kind of points to what the mainstream considers most valuable or relevant to their, you know, to their interests. But yeah, a lot of the startup world recognizing Jack Dorsey as, I suppose, an influential player within the world of fintech. So I wonder to you guys, one, what his visit, as you've observed it, signals to you, signals to the ecosystem generally, but signals to the world of fintech within the continent, especially in the light of the tweet he put out recently. He highlights Africa is this great place of potential, particularly with regards to Bitcoin. There's a certain intentionality to him mentioning that. And then, of course, putting everyone on notice that sometime in the middle of 2020, he'll be spending somewhere between 3 to 6 months being here with us, you know? Ah, bless. What do you guys think?
I think Jack Dorsey, he strikes me as someone who's in some ways ahead of the curve. He's not a typical public company CEO. But to speak to the Bitcoin piece, I suspect what he's referring to is that because Africa's payments infrastructure is in many ways underdeveloped, it's like we're seeing many interesting uses of cryptocurrencies for things like remittances, for example. And so like the fact that we don't have that invested infrastructure in the way that it would exist everywhere else, new things will find it easier to take root here and grow. That was my initial sense when I saw the tweet.
Mm. What do you think, Wiza?
Yeah, it's quite apparent that there is a gap in terms of the fragmentation of the financial services system across the continent. Like changing money between African currencies is a nightmare. And because such a gap exists, there's a unique opportunity for something to quickly come in and fill it in. My only like caveat or consideration might be around regulation, and specifically in the context of cryptocurrency, it appears that African regulators, the attitude is such that they frown upon cryptocurrencies. But as we regularize and attach more trusted brands, you know, like the Twitter brand, for example, if that were to be attached to a crypto product in Africa, I think it could really accelerate things that are going on. I want to talk specifically about an app that I'm very excited about. It's called Bitseeker. So it allows you to send money between Nigeria, Ghana, and I think one other country. You cash in via crypto or via mobile money, and then you cash out via crypto and via mobile money as well. And it's just like super neat, super useful. One of the only easy ways to get money out of Nigeria. So already we're seeing some innovation in that space. And Jack did meet with the Bitseeker founder, and he was quite excited about him as well. So
in qualitative terms, what's the value of someone like Jack Dorsey, one, visiting the continent, two, going about his visits in the way he has? I mean, it's distinctly different to the approach Bill Gates has he's probably the billionaire in that class of sort of big tech who's here the most frequently, albeit unannounced. But, and then I suppose Jack Ma is also a frequent visitor. But I mean, there's a distinct difference in the way these guys come to the contact, who they decide to meet with, and how long they stay. You know, how long he's decided to stay is also quite unique as far as Jack Dorsey. What do you think the qualitative impact of that on our ecosystem as it stands might be or could be?
I think like one thing to note about Jack Dorsey's visit specifically was that he seemed to be spending a lot of his time actually engaging with the ecosystem actors, entrepreneurs, people who are running hubs, people who are running funds and co, as opposed to the political, figures, which is what I feel, you know, these type of people who are visiting typically do. And what that signals to me is that he personally is serious about working with African entrepreneurs and is trying to plug into the existing structures that are there, as opposed to coming and imposing something from the West or elsewhere, which I think is like super, super exciting.
Also, Ruben, it's interesting to me. I mean, I've heard this view Wiz is putting forward. I've seen it everywhere on Twitter, and I mean, people obviously appreciating his approach. I find it curious, though, because one, the assumption is that, you know, folks like Jack Ma or even like the Facebook boss or whoever, one, the assumption is just because we don't hear about it doesn't necessarily mean they're not meeting with, you know, people like the people we're seeing them, you know, Jack Dorsey. I think there's an intentionality to Jack Dorsey letting us know he's meeting so-and-so and taking pictures with them and putting them forward. And I wonder if there isn't a pragmatic necessity for the, you know, for folks like Bill Gates and others going about their entrees to the continent in the way they do. We've already referenced in passing regulation. And I mean, however popular you are in the tech ecosystem, if the government says you're not going to do your thing, you're not going to do your thing.
I don't think anybody else has come with the, I guess, the apparent curiosity that he has. And also, I think if Bill Gates was visiting ecosystem players.
Yeah, people, someone would have spilled it. Yeah. Someone has a secret meeting with Bill Gates. They don't let us know on Twitter tomorrow.
Exactly.
Nah, man.
You, like I will personally
low
spill.
Key, you'd low-key ask someone else to just take a photo of you coming out of the meeting.
Precisely. But one idea that I like to play with is that founders of companies tend to view the world, use their companies as lenses through which to view the world. And so if you look at Jack Dorsey and his product, like it is absolutely native to Twitter that you would meet someone, tweet a photo of them. That's the way lots of Twitter users use Twitter. That's one of the ways Twitter should be used. On the other hand, Alibaba strikes me as, to put it in a certain way, the kind of company that would want to engage with large structures. And so when or large official structures, and so when Jack Ma comes to Africa, I guess that's the lens through which he's viewing the continent. Whereas Jack Dorsey seems to be much more of a community type person.
Given everything he has under his purview currently, who would stand to benefit the most from a co-sign, a direct investment, you know, a joining of the board, something like that from Jack Dorsey?
Before you even get there, there's actually significant value in the implied endorsement of the technology ecosystem that comes with somebody like Jack Dorsey coming down and spending time with entrepreneurs. So precisely. I find that, especially in regards to like regulation and policy making, there are not many symbols of what I can say are local champions that are decision makers at a government level can look up to for some sort of guidance. So until somebody like Jack Dorsey comes to Malawi, for example, and says like, okay, cryptocurrency is making sense, all of the people who are building on top of crypto might be ignored or looked down upon by the environment. So just his mere presence will force some people to see that there must be some value that must be unlocked. And that's difficult to quantify, obviously, but like that's the first step. In terms of like individual places he might put himself for his resources, I can't speak to that until we see it yet. But already just the trip alone will open some doors for African entrepreneurs locally.
Yeah, but also, Ruman, who do you reckon could benefit the most from? Like, imagine, say tomorrow that we fielded a press release saying Jack Dorsey joins a board or has invested in X. Who would benefit from that level of cosign right now from Jack Dorsey?
I would hesitate to speculate who.
Oh, because I suppose in some way you would be
but
sort of
to echo,
pointing to what Jack Dorsey should do if you answered the question.
In that case, I would benefit.
The subtext receives. Subtext receives. But I interrupted you. What would you say? Perhaps not even in answering the question, in sort of responding to the question in your own way.
Lots of good came from Mark Zuckerberg visiting Nigeria and Kenya, and also again through the Trans Zuckerberg Initiative making an investment in Andela. I have observed this happening with a couple of international investors who are not familiar with the continent. Like, they will Google tech in Nigeria, and it's like if you see Jack Dorsey there, that's a very positive signal. If you see Mark Zuckerberg, that's a positive signal. If you see in the news that Jack Dorsey went to three countries in Africa, has promised to come live there for 3 to 6 months, that's a signal that, you know, like we're not in the jungle, at the very least, which is a view that like a few people might subconsciously hold. I think the biggest value that I can see is like one of saying this thing is happening. And Jack Dorsey's approach of highlighting the individuals, or a few individuals who are working in the ecosystem.
Am I the only one who noticed tangible. The interesting timing of Jack Dorsey's announcement that Twitter would no longer allow politicians to advertise on Twitter, and then his visit to the continent?
It's not immediately apparent to me what the link between that is, because I feel like it was in the wake of the negative sentiment around Facebook for not having a very clear policy on how they're going to handle political advertising.
Well, there's that, but then there's also the reality that if you're going to become a player on the African continent in fintech, and you're also going to maintain your position as the CEO of one of the world's most well-branded, well-known social media apps, there could be a crisis there. There could be a sort of tension there.
Fair point. Osariman?
I would hesitate to draw that link. Like, my interpretation of his thread was like, you know, Twitter is taking a stand in this case. Again, it's not necessarily, it wasn't costing Twitter anything significant to say they were not going to accept any political advertising. And, you know, I believe they will have to work out the details of what that even means, whether that would cover like issue adverts, etc. But my sense was that it was primarily a reaction to the news that Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook would not be playing the arbiter of truth. That's my sense today.
It could also be a signal to all the politicians he probably did not visit on his trip. I suppose signaling that his presence on the continent doesn't mean that he will be somehow more accessible and more amenable to their influence. I don't know. This is just me. I just think he's in a unique position. I suppose, to be fair, it's not a terribly unique position when you consider someone like Jack Ma, who has a number of opportunities for such tensions to build, given all the different interests he oversees. But I just thought it was quite curious. And I think to transition us onto another signal, in leaving this one behind, I'd say, you know, it was also quite curious to me to see a lot of people push back on some of the joy, the jubilation, really the mostly positive sentiment folks like you and others, myself included, had about this visit. People seeing this as sort of beads and mirrors and cautioning people not to be so excited until we know what he wants and how it's going to benefit us in real ways. And I suppose there's room for that kind of thinking as well, not to be carried away. What do you guys think?
Yes, there's some validity to that sentiment. But then what is the trade-off? What are we comparing the visits and the presence of all of these Silicon Valley Chinese investors to against? Are we comparing it to nothing? And if we're comparing it to nothing, is nothing that much better? Then, you know, that's my perspective.
Leave us alone. Don't come. Yeah. Don't come. we're cool all by ourselves.
Like, yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, perfect segue to discussing the Chinese and their growing interest on the African continent. Which signal, as far as Chinese involvement over the last month or so, do you consider the most interesting, Osir Rahman?
I think Pompey's $40 million seed round was definitely the most interesting thing.
Okay, so unpack. For someone who's not familiar with that transaction, give us some light.
Okay, so I will assume that anyone who listens to this podcast is familiar with Transsion Holdings.
If people aren't, they really need to invest in more podcasts here on this platform at africantechroundup.com. Shameless plug. All right, here we go. Carry on. So Transsion.
Yes, so about a year ago, a year and a half ago, I wrote an article called Transsion's Trojan Horses, which basically tried to examine what their strategy in Africa might be. That is, they were selling phones effectively at cost or at very low margins. They were priced in such a way that many people could afford them. And like I was pushing forward the view that that was primarily a Trojan horse through which they would introduce many other services, which they would then profit from, given that they then owned the distribution infrastructure that everybody else was relying on. So if you're building a mobile app today, whatever service you're effectively making a bet that there is someone on the other side of your connection who has a mobile phone, who has a connection, who wants to consume whatever service. And owning that infrastructure is a valuable piece of, real estate, to use the word loosely. And PalmPay is Transsion's payments play. Reading the writing on the wall, we will see PalmPay come pre-installed on Tecno, Infinix, and Itel phones, which are the brands that Transsion owns. And the reason I find it most interesting is that specifically in Nigeria, it is no longer a question of OPE, quote unquote, dominating the market. There is now a race. Things have now become more interesting because OPE has a capital advantage over local companies. They also have a branding advantage, given that they probably have the most popular mobile browser, if I remember correctly, Opera, and many other distribution advantages that local companies don't have. But I know they have 100 million users in Africa. The introduction of PalmPay with a large war chest where they have and a distribution advantage has made the market interesting to analyze or to think about, because you then begin to think about Opera or OPE is going to distribute their services using very likely phones that are owned by Transsion. So which of their positions in the value chain is more valuable or gives each player more leverage? Where OPE's capital can be matched by PalmPay's distribution advantages. That's what I found most interesting.
A lot of these fintech signals we are discussing are proxies for a bigger discussion worth having about who is in a position to curate and indeed orchestrate the ultimate super platform play. And as you were talking, I just realized that there might be a small room or indeed a big room of very smart people over at a place like Google, for example, crunching all the ways everything they have purview on can be brought to bear to match the potential platform advantage Opera Transsion could have. And now I'm thinking about Google's announcement, their aspirations to be the bank of the world, essentially, within that context. I wonder if that thinking is sound, given everything you've been observing, Wiza.
Yeah, I think to some extent. But then my worry is that for the companies like Facebook and Google, you know, Facebook also announced Facebook Pay.
That's right.
Earlier.
Oh, you mean Libra Light, basically. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's not.
Calibra Network installment part one.
I suppose you can call it that, but like from the signals that I'm seeing, they're really like very separate products. And I think
no, they are. Yeah. I'm being tongue in cheek here, but I mean it's part of the plan, yeah. Guys. Let's be honest.
It is. I guess you know it's like the alpha version.
So we'll do this while, you know, the world comes around.
Yeah. So I feel like,
and also if they'd done the Facebook thing, if they'd done Facebook Pay before they launched Libra, we'd all have an even harder time imagining Libra isn't a Facebook thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yes, that's
or just a Facebook
definitely,
thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on. Sorry. I interrupt.
I feel like, yes, those are positive signals, but then I'm thinking about market prioritization. And Osarimin shared earlier this week that like a big thing that we don't consider about Africa is that it is actually a series of small fragmented markets vis-a-vis, you know, China and India, which are similar in some senses from a scale point of view to the continent. But then there are, you know, singular unified markets. So I feel like for something like Google's bank project or Facebook Pay, it'll make a lot more sense for them as global companies to start with markets like India that are easier to break into and return more on their investment and efforts than it would be to get into Africa, particularly with the context of integrating with local payment methods in each country, which vary widely. I mean, in Zimbabwe, it's EcoCash. In Malawi, it's Airtel Money, Zona, Mpamba. In Kenya, it's M-Pesa. In Nigeria, it's the banks. And one thing that we sort of like take for granted is that in order to be able to thoroughly integrate a payment method, you're going to probably need a local entity or some sort of like local presence, which I don't foresee somebody like a Google coming in to do in the short term, perhaps in the medium to long term. On the flip side, you know, someone like OPay, Africa is their primary market. So I think that the two most interesting things to happen in the last quarter or so are the $40 million fundraise by Pompey that Rosarman has alluded to, and then the $120 million Series B by OPay. And what is interesting about it for me is not the fact that they've raised $120 million, though I suppose that would be very useful. I know I could do a lot in life with $120 million. But it is that the fact that they've raised from Meituan Dianping, the Chinese super app platform with, you know, over 46,000 employees. I'm reading an article right now in the Financial Times that says that they beat expectations with a 44% rise in sales during the third quarter, achieving another profitable 3-month period. So yeah, China is a different market, but these guys clearly know what it takes to make a super app work. And what is interesting for me is the extent to which they'll be lending their expertise to companies like OPay. On the flip side, I think OPay has a massive challenge in front of it because their success in Nigeria is specific to their Nigeria execution, which they've done very, very well. But I don't know if that strategy is going to map one-to-one with in other markets. I also think,
I suppose when you consider like Transient's pretty legit regional footprint,
yep,
or sort of multi market footprint.
Yep.
And I mean, I saw a crazy number, which I can't repeat because I haven't verified it, but I mean that their free cash flow is in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, so there's that to contend with as well.
Yeah. And one thing that's unique about Transient, I guess in the context of this super app thing, is the amount of groundwork that they're doing. So last month, there was a China-Africa Mobile Internet Economy Summit. It was a closed-door, invite-only event, primarily sponsored by Transient Techno, in Nairobi, and they revealed that like they've already got licenses to do mobile money, like to operate the entire full stack of mobile money in like 5 markets. And I have noticed a trend where TransUnion is poaching telco execs or ex-telco people who already have their relationships in place in each of these markets to be able to build out this, you know, full scale mobile money operations. A caveat around that is that somebody like a Pompey will be seen more directly as a competitor to telco-led mobile money solutions than an OPay because of how they've positioned themselves. And there's some interesting questions there around to what extent will telcos let organizations like Pompey operate over-the-top mobile money services that directly cannibalize and compete with theirs, especially because it's clear that these guys are setting up their own agency networks, so they're not going to be leveraging existing mobile money solutions. And I think that's where the real fight is going to be, not amongst the super app players themselves, but it's going to be more like super apps versus telcos. And I don't know how that's going to really, really play out. And I'm concerned foremost for the smaller fintechs that have got really innovative services that people like, but they don't have the capital to be able to compete with the marketing machinery of OPay. OPay launched a car sharing, a ride sharing service, and they're offering rides for 200 naira. This is just over half of a dollar anywhere in Lagos. If I start my ride-sharing startup today, WizRide, will I be able to compete?
Not quite. Not for long. Osamrem?
While I agree that some local companies will find it difficult to compete, I tend to take the view that we should look at the world as it is. That is, OPay is in the market, full stop. Pompey is in the market, full stop. Any businesses that rely on charging consumers transaction fees, they're probably not getting to significant scale anymore. And it's like, I guess the question would then be, what do you build on top of that infrastructure? Or what kinds of companies will succeed in a world where many consumers have not been educated and they are now more comfortable using digital services? Initially because they wanted to get like free lunch, literally. But afterwards, maybe that begins to expand the total addressable market for fintechs or for technology companies more broadly. But, like in the country and
yeah, and yeah, I suppose. I suppose.
What do you think about that, Lisa?
Fair. That's a fair point. I'm just curious to see like what it actually, how it actually plays out in practice. I would love for somebody like Pompey and OPay to release APIs, but given their strategies around sort of getting people into this like walled garden, I wonder if they really have any incentives to do so. I'll draw a parallel with like, with Apple's payment product. I'm pretty sure developers in the West would love to see like Apple Pay APIs can integrate directly. But then Apple has an incentive to get more and more people into that walled garden. So you've got this like, you know, chicken egg scenario. And my worry is that most companies won't survive the waiting period that it'll take for these companies to reach the critical mass that is required for it to make sense for them to start releasing APIs. I mean, Safaricom M-Pesa has been alive for over a decade, and we only saw the Daraja API released two years ago or so, you know, and it's only last year when they started like aggressively promoting it after they had captured enough value within the closed loop. So that's why I'm just concerned.
Perhaps there's something worth reading into in, Jack Dorsey in intentionally citing Bitcoin as, I guess, part of the future of African fintech, right? I think it's conspicuous in the context of how it doesn't force him to align with existing structures that basically engineer frictions that prevent mass adoption or mass dissemination of these technologies. Basically, it almost sounds to me like while he's trying to figure out who to partner with, if he will at all, he's probably surveyed the treacherous nature of all these walled garden plays or all these players who are trying to beat the next guy out to having everything to themselves. Also, Ruman, you are like, you like to look at things as they are. Things as they are that like there's a ton of engineered complexity in this space that exists, that has a direct consequence on how quickly all of this can become a mainstream part of how we transact and do business. that dynamic is also in part the reason why there isn't a default advantage to, say, Google or a Facebook or an Apple, even with their entrees into the space, you know, at scale around the world. Because those at-scale advantages don't necessarily apply in a world where all of these frictions exist.
I resonate with that view. It is obvious that market by market is maybe not worth it for, say, a Facebook or a Google to invest the resources or plant the flags needed to, quote unquote, take over. If I worked at one of those companies, like, I would pick 2, 3, 4 markets and concentrate my attention in the short to medium term, and probably work with aggregators, like, to develop some presence, which over in the long term can then get deepened. So, like, if I was a Facebook trying to push Facebook Pay or Libra, I would, like, look at, obviously, Nigeria, look at Kenya, look at many of the markets where there seems to be the most economic activity digitally, or the most mature digital ecosystems as observed from my platform, and then partner with whoever's big there. And I'm very sure many local companies would kill to be the on-ramps onto Libra, even given a global perception is that Libra's chances are now much worse than they were before. To speak to Bitcoin specifically, I do think in many ways cryptocurrencies solve actual problems with moving money and other use cases across the continent. A few weeks ago, we had to transfer money from Nigeria to Kenya, and even sometimes from Kenya to Nigeria. And like Bitcoin has been a very useful remittance tool, even though it's not an officially sanctioned one. Like trying to use any of the existing services was just too cumbersome. Either I was going to get charged like lots of fees, the actual restrictions in place, such that I couldn't move money out of Nigeria. Meanwhile, one of us will buy Bitcoin, send to the other one liquidates that Bitcoin, like money has been transferred in less than an hour, basically free. It's talked about a lot as a good use case, but actually experiencing it.
Like, and I mean, there was this article I read, this Bitcoin whale, like offloaded, I think, nearly $500 million worth of Bitcoin, I think paid something like less than 40 cents for the transaction. So, I mean, there's a somewhat compelling case for affordable remittances via Bitcoin. But I think there's this open source vibe to Bitcoin as a notion, right? That isn't represented by any of these, you know, this OPE, Pompey, by any of these guys. That I think there's a real intentionality to someone like Jack Dorsey, like going out of his way to mention that. You know?
Yeah, I think like, you know, the big thing about the signal that I got from Jack's tweet about Bitcoin was that it makes a lot of sense as the digital value store that we can play around with continentally. Again, because of the fragmentation issue, we have like currency issues. So even if I have M-Pesa and M-Pesa is across Africa, I still have to manage M-Pesa in like 50 plus currencies, which is a nightmare. And then two, Bitcoin is extensible by default. So we're not waiting for a Bitcoin API. It is like truly digitally native. You can plug it into various things. So that's a massive plus. The only area where I think it falls short is like accessibility. There's still a ton of technical overhead required, for an individual to play around with it, though that's soon going to change. There's an interesting startup called Dial Crypto. So they're making it possible for people to create and manage wallets via USSD, which I think is like incredible. Whether or not the telcos would let them deploy that at scale and integrate with mobile money is another story altogether and beyond.
And whether regulators won't see that entire game as a big move to undermine, you know,
their monetary policy. Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Know. So
we saw this with
in Kenya.
Yeah, I was going to say we saw this with BitPesa and M-Pesa or Safaricom in Kenya.
Yeah. So unpack that for people not familiar with that situation, guys.
It would appear that there was resistance from Safaricom in Kenya in regards to a product called BitPesa. Specifically because it allowed people to buy and sell Bitcoin via M-Pesa. And, you know, we're not very sure what happened from the outside looking in, but it seemed that BitPesa was blocked from operating on top of M-Pesa, and they've had to make a lot of, changes to their business and their platform in order to keep operating in Kenya.
And so I just wanted to reference the actual tweet. I don't know why I didn't read it earlier, that Jack Dorsey put out recently. He said, sad to be leaving the continent for now. Africa will define the future, in brackets, especially the Bitcoin one. Not sure where yet, but I'll be living here for 3 to 6 months, mid-2020. Grateful I was able to experience a small part. Now, that's the tweet I guess I'm reading into as we make this discussion. And, you know, let's talk about, I think, the most significant local, I suppose, success story. I think this one's the one that easily, I think, got the most people excited, because after the Jumia embarrassment, it turns out like the first African unicorn was a dud. And I say that quote unquote, as far as them being the first African unicorn. Now we have the true or the legit African unicorn or homegrown unicorn. Like people, the homegrown unicorn, which is Interswitch, are landing an investment from Visa that puts the company's valuation at $1 billion, a fairly sizable investment. I want to know what you guys think about this investment and what it signals, but I found it quite curious that some of the big name brands within our ecosystem who lauded the Jumia deal, like unreservedly, almost to the point of embarrassing defensiveness, as something good for the ecosystem and the continent and good for the world, without missing a step, just go, well, Interswitch is the new big deal. So yeah, what do you guys make of this? What does it signal, given everything you know about Interswitch?
So there's two things to unpack. Number one is the Africanness. I'm not an expert in the Africanness or Africanality of companies.
Osa Ruman is bristling even as you say that.
Yeah,
we have long and passionate conversations about whether or not that's even relevant to this discussion.
But assuming that it is, I feel like Interswitch feels more African than the Jumia does. So that's
because it is, but I won't make that a problem.
That's one thing. So that's pretty interesting. Okay. Number two is that the unit economics and the financial performance of the business is quite tangible and based on metrics that are already existing. So they're not raising this money because they want to run an experiment or find a new business model.
Or because they've told a good story.
Yeah. It's actually a tangible, solid business. So I think that the valuation would stick even in the public markets after the IPO, hopefully next year. And then it's also a fantastic story for African founders who are, you know, trying to really get into the fintech space and trying to figure out what their future might look like in 10 years, in 15 years. Like, what does an actual exit path look like? Are exits actually possible? Because prior to this Interswitch deal, we didn't know that you could build a unicorn or that you could exit in this way. So I think the significance is more around the symbolism. For me, it's about the symbolism for myself as an African founder, knowing that like I could be like Mitchell one day, who's the founder and CEO of Interswitch. So yeah, that to me are the biggest things. I'm not going to talk much about the Jumia.
No, we don't have to revisit Jumia. Yeah. But they don't.
You know this. The stock is up 6.24% this morning, but that's a story for
whatever.
Another time.
Whatever. I don't care. I think Jason Njoku's really excited about that right now because he tweeted the other day that he's putting some loose change on that stock because he felt it was sufficiently discounted enough to warrant a gamble. Whatever, which is exactly what it is, a gamble. And that's okay. If you're into gambles, that's fine. Or you can certainly sustain it as part of your portfolio, to speculate. That's fine. But let's not joke. Let's not be jocular. Eh? Let's not be jocular. This thing is this. Yeah. See, you're dragging me back down, bro. You're taking me back. You're triggering me.
I'm already triggered.
I need to talk myself. No one is. But I wanted to ask Osa Ruman, for people who are not familiar with Interswitch, how are they being so great at being a business in Nigeria?
The company was founded in 2002, I believe, which means a 17-year-old company, which I guess should be a signal to both founders and investors for like how long the journey is.
Preach.
So this is not a 4-year journey. Again, if you want to build something of this scale, but InterSwitch strikes me. I don't know too much about the company internally, but it strikes me as a very traditionally run company. So when you use the word startup, I cringed a bit because nothing about the company signals that it's a startup. And in fact, before the new wave of payments players like the Paystacks, the Flutterwaves of this world, the Amplify Pays, before they got acquired, InterSwitch, I believe, did not have were not taking a developer first approach to the market. So they're primarily a business.
Leveraging strong relationships they've made with, from what I understand, local government, utilities firms, and things of that nature.
Yes, they connect different banks.
There you go.
Their switching infrastructure.
I guess my question to you also, Ruben, given how you brought up this point earlier on, is if you are working at, say, Pompey or Opay, even like the larger players who might not have an immediate direct interest in sort of getting in the mud with everyone else to sort of try and capture these fragmented markets, so Google Pay, Apple Pay, whoever, how would you look at InterSwitch as a potential success to emulate or a threat to mitigate?
My initial sense is that I'll treat InterSwitch as a partner and none of the things you mentioned. That is, find ways to collaborate with them to create new value as opposed to competing for, I guess, the same cake. Mostly because some of the signals I've seen across these markets suggest to me that while elsewhere, the David and Goliath story where you come in and defeat existing structures is seductive, I'm not sure to what extent it is true in a market like Nigeria, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, where InterSwitch does business.
Sure. Fascinating discussion so far. Let's head down south with the next few things. Let's talk Bank Zero, which is the latest digital bank to launch in South Africa following the likes of Tyme Bank and Discovery Bank. It's an exclusively digital bank. It's quite famously backed by Michael Jordan, who is credited with taking First National Bank in South Africa from a sort of stodgy legacy institution to what up until maybe the launch of, I'd say, Capitec Bank would be the most sort of agile, sort of modern legacy banking institution, right, in South Africa. And so he left FNB some years ago and has since become easily one of the more high-profile venture capitalists operating within South Africa, within the fintech scene. And so Bank Zero was launched in South Africa with much fanfare. You know, they were promising takedowns. They were, you know, putting out very cheeky tweets about how, you know, time was up for time and things like that, or the time was right for something new. I'm not quoting him here, but I mean, there was a lot of intentional sort of ribbing on the part of Michael Jordan and his team at Bank Zero, just suggesting that they were going to do things in ways that had never been done before. They've launched this card that is supposed to be far more secure than any of the plastic out there at the moment. Things of that nature, right? And what's really interesting is his former employer, FNB, was cheeky enough to launch a product with the word zero in it in the same week. The CEO of FNB's consumer division, Christoph Niewood, was asked about why they did that. He was like, oh, it was just purely coincidental. Their new brand, Easy Zero, the zero fee account they just launched, has nothing to do with the fact that Bank Zero just launched. So guys, I don't know what you make about this whole digital banking wave. I think of companies like Carbon, who are styling themselves around the vibe of banks in Europe, like Sterling and
Monzo.
And Monzo and Revolut. What do you make of banking a la this whole sort of digital first, digital only thing? And how relevant is it to the African context or within the context of the markets you guys observe most closely?
What do you reckon? Somebody who enjoys going into a bank branch. It's a process that's full of friction. It felt antiquated the first time I opened my first bank account when I was young. I was like, why do you need all this documentation? And I think it's something that is fundamentally begging to be disrupted. So digital banks are going to, succeed in a world of instant gratification and, where my smartphone can do anything. Because of this, I think digital banks are going to struggle to differentiate amongst each other's services, because there's really not much that you can offer that's different from, you know, the next digital bank. People like the convenience of being able to open an account on their phone, they get their card, whatever else. All of their money is probably transacted electronically anyway. So there's very little need for cash. De La Rue, I think the company that prints currency for the UK and many African companies is struggling financially, looking for
countries. You mean
is struggling financially and is looking for a bailout. That signals to me that the demand for cash is decreasing, and this is a trend that's consistent globally. I think that these initial iterations that we're seeing will filter out naturally all of the players that are not solid or reliable. And then in the end, there'll be like, you know, four or five primary digital bank players in each market, the way they are banks today in today's structure. It's going to just take the same model. But what will change is that the distribution will be on the app as opposed to the branch. But it's here and there's nothing that can be done to change it. What's interesting about this Bank Zero versus Easy Zero phenomenon is that Easy Zero on FNB is a USSD application that can reach more phones. It seems that Bank Zero is a smartphone only offering. So I think FNB may have one-upped Mr. Jordan over there. But maybe they'll attract a different caliber of customer. The more sophisticated user will prefer a smartphone experience and may be willing to pay more. But then for the mass market, something along the USSD lines might be more attractive. But yeah, this thing is here to stay.
It does appear like Bank Zero and Discovery Bank are going after a sort of high-end consumer or a sort of high net worth consumer, and are probably looking to harass like the big four's private clients and private clients is used loosely. I'm an FNB private client, and I can assure you that there's a sort of prestige that name implies that is not something I experience as a private client.
VIP.
But yeah, so there's the private clients, and then there's obviously sort of private banking beyond that. And I imagine Discovery Bank and Bank Zero kind of to a larger degree appealing to folks like me and people who are sort of in the tax bracket that allow them those services from the existing banks. And then the likes of Time Bank targets, to my mind, the kind of clientele that, you know, has found Capitec a compelling proposition relative to everything that existed before Capitec came to be. So, and I suppose it's interesting for me to observe a brand like Capitec sort of mull over potential disruption, given how effectively they've been at disrupting, you know, the comfort in the low end market that some of the banks have had before. I wonder why this feels like someone's dad at an 18 year old party trying to rap like Drake. You know what I mean? It kind of feels like this 55 year old man at a party with all these kids, and you know, I'm still cool, kids. You know, granted we're not cashless yet, and the future isn't here yet, but I wonder if banks are, you know, do they have folks like you speaking to them with that, you know, or advising them?
Yeah, I think like maybe because we're used to the first movers in other markets being independent startups who are trying to compete with incumbents. Now, what I'm observing on the continent, at least for markets like Kenya, is that startups don't have anywhere near the capacity that is required to launch a full-scale bank. There are some notable exceptions like Kuda in Nigeria, who actually have like a microfinance bank license so they can control the full banking stack and appify it to the degree that they want. But the offerings by some banks like CBA Loop in Kenya is pretty compelling. The app works. It's very modern. The features are very robust. So I think they're catching up, but it'll take a bit of time. And ultimately, because they have embedded themselves within the banking industry, which is notorious for being exclusive and being resistant to innovation, they're the ones that are going to succeed. I'd rather, as a startup, get acquired by a bank and, you know, make a very fancy UI or UX, and as opposed to trying to compete with them. And we just need to be a bit more patient, but yeah, it's going to happen. in my view.
Again, I just heard your voice in my head, Osaruman, on some, we must, you know, evaluate things as they are. And the truth is, banks are probably stressed and they're probably not making as much money as easily as they ever have, but they're still.
Yeah, it can't be that bad. I mean, that's not about private customers such as yourself ensuring that they have recurring revenues. I'm pretty sure they're not suffering.
I wish you knew my struggle with that, with this private clients thing and how it's just ridiculous. By the way, I mean, I'm already partly sold given how needing to frequent the UK, I needed to be banked there in my personal capacity. And I was totally unable to land, you know, a NatWest account or a Halifax account or, you know, one of the bigger, you know, HSBC account, all the paperwork you were talking about earlier. Revolut, presumably because I'm already pre-vetted by PayPal, which is, you know, a partner of theirs in the back, if not invested in them, I'm not sure. I don't know what went into them being able to bank me so readily and easily to get me a virtual card and mail me a card. It made me realize just how like the incumbents are missing a trick. But then it made me wonder to what extent, you know, the frictions I'd encountered even through that process reflect the frictions of an everyday African who's looking to be banked, or frankly, doesn't even think of banking as this activity called banking. It's just, I'm trying to get things done. I'm trying to move money X, Y, Z. I'm trying to pay my workers. I'm trying to pay school fees. And in the context of like people who think in those utilitarian terms, is zero fee banking an innovation worth celebrating? Perhaps. I don't know.
I think zero fee banking is, I guess, the bare minimum moving forward. Given the trends that we're seeing.
We've been spoiled. That's the new floor. Spoiled.
Like now, when I think about like paying for a transfer, I'm like, why? Why should I pay for this? Nigeria, for example, right? Now the idea of like charging transaction fees for transfers is not very compelling. And I think I worry that as part of the strategies to drive adoption of these digital services, they are creating unsustainable business models, some of them with like negative unit economics.
And getting us hooked and getting us addicted to it as consumers.
NCBA Loop gives me money back every time I swipe my card for amounts over $20. Like they give me money for using the card. I'm not complaining. Like I like the money, but then if I was an NCBA shareholder, I might be very concerned about where they're going to recoup this money that they are giving me. But I imagine that the idea is to hit a certain volume or a certain scale where the interest on your deposits, more than makes up for, the money that is being spent. And then the question that comes from that would be, how much room is there for such type of players? Because if everyone is depending on scale, then you can't have like, you know, 10 players. It means like there must be like 1, 2, or 3 at most. And
which is why the super app play or the super platform play is a thing. It's a race to build the supermarket. So guys, let's take it to Zimbabwe. All right. Where NetOne, which is the government owned telco in Zimbabwe, competitor to the more well PR'd Econet, famous for EcoCash and other innovations. So NetOne recently announced that they would be doing exactly what we're talking about. Give up the revenue they'd otherwise earn by charging you to use their money transfer service, presumably for the future benefit of having you sign up with them and maybe monetize you some other way. What do you guys make of this, man? And do you think this is a trend that could take hold in other markets where mobile telcos with sort of dominant or in fact not so dominant mobile money services look to sort of disrupt the market leader? So say Airtel in Kenya looks at M-Pesa and goes, you know what? We're just going to make transfers absolutely free on our network and try and steal away as many M-Pesa users from Safaricom as possible. Can you imagine a world where that would happen or could happen?
Yes, it could happen. I don't know to what extent it's going to be effective because the most important feature of Safaricom's M-Pesa is that everyone who I want to pay already has it. Like regardless of the transaction fees, like I don't
the network effect,
yeah,
or the established network, yeah,
exactly. So maybe completely free transfers is a way to build that network, but in itself, I don't see that like changing.
Right. Don't you see this as a great experiment for why do people in Zimbabwe use EcoCash? Is it because it's the most reliable service? Is it straight up people don't have a choice?
Yeah, I think it's closer to the latter of people not having a choice. If I can borrow from Osariman's words, he once described something as being ubiquitous to the point of invisibility.
That is so Osariman, yeah. So sensei right there.
And like M-Pesa in Kenya is expensive. It is actually really, really expensive, but I don't have a choice.
Yep. So is EcoCash.
Yeah, like you don't have a choice. Crazy. Because everyone that you want to pay and all of the merchants that are there are only exclusively accepting EcoCash. I think in markets where you have native mobile money interoperability, like Tanzania, I think Tanzania and Malawi are the only two countries where I've seen really native mobile money interop, then that sort of strategy can work because I can still pay everyone else free of charge and then they would get the e-value in their home mobile money network at the same value that I sent it. What I mean by this is that if Zimbabwe had native mobile money interop and you are on NetOne and you sent me $200 because Andele are wealthy like that, for free, I would still receive $200 in my EcoCash. In a market like that, it makes sense. But where there isn't native mobile money interop, I think it will maybe juice the numbers for a bit as people try it out, but it won't gain repeated traction because it'll introduce more friction than using the incumbent mobile money method. And the trade-off is always between convenience and cost.
We need to factor in how long a NetOne has to sustain losses.
Yes, sure. Yes. And you know,
or on their way to, you know, recouping on this decision.
Yeah. And from the outside looking in, it doesn't appear as though NetOne have, you know, $120 million Series B to spend.
But then the other thing is maybe this also speaks to just how cheaply these transactions are happening. What we were paying for SMS in 98, clearly had nothing to do with what it actually cost to deliver the service, right?
Yep, 100%. The big thing about mobile money is the cost of maintaining agency networks. I think the unit economics are a bit more honest.
I am oversimplifying the situation though, but I mean, we are coming off a money printing spree that came to a head maybe 5-6 years ago. I mean, they were literally printing money. And there wasn't always a correlation between what people were being charged, even before the whole OTT dynamic, you know, properly set in, you know? It will be really interesting to see if, NetOne can shake the dominance of EcoCash by making this happen. Also, but does this signal a policy shift in the Zimbabwean government's attitude towards EcoCash? You know, Econet's been accused in the past of being strangely okay with the Zimbabwean government, or at least okay enough to operate as well as they have, and you know, people questioning their integrity as a result. Can't speculate too much in that direction, but is this the Zimbabwean government saying, well, we've kind of had enough of allowing Econet through EcoCash to have the dominance they're having in our sort of monetary system? We are ready to take it back. Perhaps that's what's happening here, and this is part one. I look forward to seeing how this plays out. In the meantime, heck, I'm so glad my family in Zimbabwe have an option that is far cheaper than what they've been charged on EcoCash. Granted, sending money in general is a mission, so it's quite rich for them to launch this right now when the monetary system is as stressed as it is. But the one thing I forgot to add earlier, I promised this would be the last one, your thoughts on Google's decision to sort of ban predatory lending on the Google Play Store and the impact or non-impact this might have on microlenders operating on the African continent. So Africa-focused or Africa-based startups that have come to rely on the App Store to acquire customers on the African continent.
I think it was getting out of hand in Kenya, at least. The top 10 apps on the Kenya, top 10 finance apps on the Kenya Play Store are all credit apps, like each and every single one of them. It was getting out of hand. Some of them had ridiculous interest rates, and I think Google made the right move to sort of like regularize that and make it more easier to manage for people who are being exposed to credit for the first time. A lot of the framing and language in the products is misleading. There are very few that are actually going about it in a way that I would describe as ethical. So I think it was like definitely the right move, and it's timely. Otherwise, it was going to create a credit crisis at some point. So I'm all for it. And I think that it does change. It does, you know, change the opportunity for some credit players, but then it's not that bad. Like, you can do 60-day credit, you won't die.
Also, you can sort of just you can offer lending like a percent lower than the limit, than the prescribed limit, and get away with that. Also, Ruben, given the fan you are of capitalism, and I say this tongue in cheek because I know you have a very nuanced view of what good capitalism should look like, but I think on the whole you're a big fan of capitalism, and I wonder if this is not a worrying overstepping. Just let the market be, Google. Like, isn't this like a worrying signal of the power of a platform like Google to regulate our decision to get money from who we want, and the market's right to offer services that, you know, people are demanding? Surely this is a trampling of our capitalist interests.
Nice caricature of my position there, Andile.
And maybe people are going to get this so wrong because they're not privy to our conversations outside this.
So,
but I really am being tongue-in-cheek here. But you know, give it a bash, bro. What do you think?
So about the industry in itself, I want to borrow from something Weezer said earlier, that you should compare this to the alternative and not to nothing. So the alternative credit industry, specifically for Western Africa and I guess other developing markets, exists because the credit industry failed to serve those customers. And so I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the constraints they have to navigate, given some of their tactics. I find morally reprehensible. At the same time, I recognize that they are dealing with a different risk profile, and a whole different situation than the traditional credit industry that I guess sets our expectations for what, say, normal interest rates should look like. And so in a country like Nigeria, where I think interest rates are 26% or so. So think about what that does to the cost of capital for some of these players in Nigeria. I imagine the situation is not much different elsewhere. And then consider these are unsecured loans. The bucket of risk is completely different. And so I would hesitate to compare it directly to, what we who I guess are participating in the more traditional economy view as normal. That said, I think Google doing what they're doing is the market doing its thing, frankly. Google, I believe, does not have too much to say in, you know, whatever, say, a player like Transion does, for example. So Palm Credit will absolutely continue to be distributed because it comes bundled alongside, like, all Tecno, Infinix, and I believe Itel phones. So it's like if you either have a distribution advantage or your service is popular enough, then there's ways to get around that. So you see that Netflix, both Netflix and I think Fortnite, are circumventing, the Google Play Store. Cause it's like they are compelling enough that users will find a way to get them anyways. And so I wouldn't lose too much sleep about it, quite frankly.
And to be fair, Google is acting, at least as far as I can tell, more in response to the, you know, the pushback against payday loan apps in the US,
yes,
then they are sort of trying to solve for the growing micro lending issues we have on the African continent, right? So as far as I know, they haven't even made a statement about how they expect this decision to impact everyone else. But also how they framed it is, I think they framed it quite delicately. They're like, listen, we're just changing the terms of our app store. They haven't come out in, we are looking to regulate the scene, which I suppose speaks to what you're saying. They're within their rights as a company to do what they believe is right or should exist or happen on their platform.
Yep. Capitalism wins.
Yeah, this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm pretty sure we've left out a number of signals, but as usual, it's impossible to be exhaustive on our show. I'm hoping that our listeners will at very least be spurred to researching some of the signals we've referenced, especially when it comes to Africa. We do ourselves a disservice when we just buy in hook, line, and sinker to any one person trying to sell us one thing. So, gentlemen, I couldn't be more pleased with who I've had the opportunity to share this conversation with. Again, everything we've discussed and we've referenced in the show will be available in the show notes. So head there if you're interested in learning more and reading into some of the things that are influencing our thinking right now. There's an incredible article by Wizza unpacking his notion of mobile money 2.0. That's worth checking out. There's an essay series by The Subtext in partnership with DFS that's currently on the go, worth subscribing to. If you missed the webinar, it's actually still available to consume post the fact. That's also worth tucking into, especially if you've got an investment interest in the space. And of course, africantechroundup.com is a standing resource for you if you just like to observe the ecosystem in general and just take in some of the conversations we've had, not just in the recent past, but as far back as we've existed. That's all available to you at africantechroundup.com. We'd love to hear from you, though. Hit us up on Instagram or Twitter at africanroundup. Drop us an email via hello@africantechroundup.com. We'd love to hear what you make of everything we've said. Disagree if you must. Challenge our notions. Push back on the caricature of Osa Ruman's capitalist self-interest. We'd love to hear it all. Give us a shout and let us know what you're feeling. Wizza Chalakasi, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, guys. Really fantastic discussion.
Shout out to the chill shores of Lake Malawi.
Yebo.
And of course, Osa Ruman, Osa Mui, as always, thank you for what you do at The Subtext and for lending your swag to this show.
Thank you so much, Andele, for having me. And thank you, Wizza, for gracing us with your presence.
Pleasure's all mine.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Andile Masugu. Take it easy, Africa.